It would have to be Sir Kevin. Her uncle was tireless, prudent, unfailingly obedient. She could rely on him as her father had. The hand does not argue with the head. She had a realm to rule, but she would need new men to help her rule it. Pycelle was a doddering lickspittle. Jamie had lost his courage with his sword hand, and Mace Tyrell and his cronies Redwine and Rowan could not be trusted. For all she knew, they might have had a part in this. Lord Tyrell had to know that he would never rule the Seven Kingdoms so long as Tywin Lannister lived. I will need to move carefully with that one. The city was full of his men, and he'd even managed to plant one of his sons in the Kingsguard, and meant to plant his daughter in Tommen's bed. It still made her furious to think that father had agreed to betroth Tommen to Marjorie Tyrell. The girl is twice his age and twice widowed. Mace Tyrell claimed his daughter was still virgin, but Circe had her doubts. Joffrey had been murdered before he could bed the girl, but she had been wed to Renly first. A man may prefer the tastes of Hippocras, yet if you set a tankard of ale before him, he will quaff it quick enough. She must command Lord Varys to find out what he could. That stopped her where she stood. She had forgotten about Varys. He should be here. He is always here. Whenever anything of import happened in the Red Keep, the eunuch appeared as if from nowhere. Jamie is here, and Uncle Kevin and Pycelle has come and gone, but not Varys. A cold finger touched her spine. He was part of this. He must have feared that father meant to have his head, so he struck first. Lord Tywin had never had any love for the simpering master of whisperers, and if any man knew the Red Keep's secrets, it was surely the master of whisperers. He must have made common cause with Lord Stannis. They served together on Robert's council, after all. Circe strode to the door of the bedchamber to Sir Merin Trant. Trant! Bring me Lord Varys, squealing and squirming if need be, but unharmed. As your grace commands. But no sooner had one Kingsguard departed than another one returned. Sir Boros Blunt was red-faced and puffing from his headlong rush up the steps.
Gone!
He panted when he saw the Queen. He sank to one knee.
The imp! His cells open. Your grace, no sign of him anywhere.
The dream was true.
I gave orders,
she said. He was to be kept under guard night and day. Blount's chest was heaving. One of the jailers has gone missing too. Rugen, his name was. Two other men we found asleep. It was all she could do not to scream. I hope you did not wake them, Sir Boros. Let them sleep.
Sleep?
He looked up, jowly and confused.
Aye, Your Grace, how long shall...
Forever. See that they sleep forever, sir. I will not suffer guards to sleep on watch. He is in the walls. He killed father as he killed mother as he killed Joff. The dwarf would come for her as well, the queen knew, just as the old woman had promised her in the dimness of that tent. I laughed in her face, but she had powers. I saw my future in a drop of blood. My doom. Her legs were weak as water. Sir Boros tried to take her by the arm, but the queen recoiled from his touch. For all she knew, he might be one of Tyrion's creatures.
Get away from me, she said. Get away!
She staggered to a settle.
Your grace, said Blount, shall I fetch a cup of water?
It is blood I need, not water.
Tyrion's blood, the blood of the Valonqar.
The torches spun around her. Circe closed her eyes and saw the dwarf grinning at her.
No, she thought. No, I was almost rid of you.
But his fingers had closed around her neck and she could feel them beginning to tighten.
Daenerys. Her brother held a gown up for her inspection. This is beauty. Touch it. Go on. Caress the fabric. Danny touched it. The cloth was so smooth that it seemed to run through her fingers like water. She could not remember ever wearing anything so soft. It frightened her. She pulled her hand away. Is it really mine?
A gift from the Magister Illyrio, Viserys said, smiling. Her brother was in a high mood tonight. The colour will bring out the violet in your eyes, and you shall have gold as well and jewels of all sorts. Illyrio has promised. Tonight you must look like a princess.
A princess, Danny thought. She had forgotten what that was like. Perhaps she had never really known.
Why does he give us so much, she asked. What does he want from us?
For nigh on half a year they had lived in the Magister's house, eating his food, pampered by his servants. Danny was 13, old enough to know that such gifts seldom come without their price, here in the free city of Pentos.
Illyrio is no fool, Viserys said.
He was a gaunt young man with nervous hands and a feverish look in his pale lilac eyes.
The Magister knows that I will not forget my friends when I come into my throne.
Danny said nothing. Magister Illyrio was a dealer in spices, gemstones, dragon bone, and other less savory things. He had friends in all the 9 free cities, it was said, and even beyond, in Vase Dothrak and the fabled lands beside the Jade Sea. It was also said that he had never had a friend he wouldn't cheerfully sell for the right price. Danny listened to the talk in the streets, and she heard these things, but she knew better than to question her brother when he wove his web of dreams. His anger was a terrible thing when roused. Viserys called it waking the dragon. Her brother hung the gown beside the door.
Illyrio will send the slaves to bathe you. Be sure you wash off the stink of the stables. Khal Drogo has 1,000 horses. Tonight he looks for a different sort of mount.
He studied her critically.
You still slouch. Straighten yourself.
He pushed back her shoulders with his hands.
Let them see that you have a woman's shape now.
His fingers brushed lightly over her budding breasts and tightened on a nipple.
You will not fail me tonight. If you do, it will go hard for you. You don't want to wake the dragon, do you?
His fingers twisted her, the pinch cruelly hard through the rough fabric of her tunic.
Do you?
He repeated.
No,
said Danny meekly. Her brother smiled.
Good.
He touched her hair almost with affection.
When they write the history of my reign, sweet sister, they will say that it began tonight.
When he was gone, Danny went to her window and looked out wistfully on the waters of the bay. The square brick towers of Pentos were black silhouettes outlined against the setting sun. Danny could hear the singing of the red priests as they lit the night fires and the shouts of ragged children playing games beyond the walls of the estate. For a moment she wished she could be out there with them, barefoot and breathless and dressed in tatters, with no past, no future, and no feast to attend at Khal Drogo's manse. Somewhere beyond the sunset, across the narrow sea, lay a land of green hills and flowered plains and great rushing rivers, where towers of dark stone rose amidst magnificent blue-grey mountains, and armoured knights rode to battle beneath the banners of their lords. The Dothraki call that land Rayush Andali, the land of the Andals. In the free cities they talked of Westeros and the Sunset Kingdoms. Her brother had a simpler name. Our land, he called it. The words were like a prayer with him. If he said them enough, the gods were sure to hear.
Ours by blood right. Taken from us by treachery, but ours still, ours forever. You do not steal from the dragon. Oh, no, the dragon remembers.
And perhaps the dragon did remember, but Danny could not. She had never seen this land her brother said was theirs, this realm beyond the narrow sea. These places he talked of, Casterly Rock and the Eyrie, High Garden and the Vale of Erin, Dawn and the Isle of Faces, they were just words to her. Viserys had been a boy of 8 when they fled the King's Landing to escape the advancing armies of the usurper, but Daenerys had been only a quickening in her mother's womb. Yet sometimes Danny would picture the way it had been, so often had her brother told her the stories.
The midnight flight to Dragonstone, moonlight shimmering on the ship's black sails, her brother Rhaegar battling the usurper in the bloody waters of the Trident and dying for the woman he loved. The sack of King's Landing, by the ones Viserys called the Usurper's Dogs. The Lords Lannister and Stark. Princess Elia of Dorne, pleading for mercy as Rhaegar's heir was ripped from her breast and murdered before her eyes. The polished skulls of the last dragon staring down sightlessly from the walls of the throne room, while the Kingslayer opened father's throat with a golden sword. She had been born on Dragonstone 9 moons after their flight, while a raging summer storm threatened to rip the island fastness apart. They said that storm was terrible. The Targaryen fleet was smashed while it lay at anchor, and huge stone blocks were ripped from the parapets and sent hurtling into the wild waters of the narrow sea. Her mother had died birthing her, and for that her brother, Viserys, had never forgiven her. She did not remember Dragonstone either. They had run again, just before the usurper's brother set sail with his new-built fleet. By then only Dragonstone itself, the ancient seat of the house, had remained of the 7 kingdoms that had once been theirs. It would not remain for long. The garrison had been prepared to sell them to the usurper, but one night Sir Willem Darry and 4 loyal men had broken into the nursery and stolen them both, along with her wet nurse, and set sail under cover of darkness for the safety of the Bravosian coast. She remembered Sir Willem dimly, a great grey bear of a man, half-blind, roaring and bellowing orders from his sickbed. The servants had lived in terror of him, but he had always been kind to Danny. He called her Little Princess, and sometimes My Lady, and his hands were soft as old leather. He never left his bed, though, and the smell of sickness clung to him day and night, a hot, moist, sickly, sweet odour. That was when they lived in Braavos, in the big house with the red door. Danny had her own room there, with a lemon tree outside her window. After Sir Willem had died, the servants had stolen what little money they had left, and soon after they had been put out of the big house. Danny had cried when the red door closed behind them forever. They had wandered since then, from Braavos to Myr, from Myr to Tyrosh, and unto Cohor, and Volantis, and Lice, never staying long in any one place. Her brother would not allow it. The usurper's hard knives were close behind them, he insisted, though Danny had never seen one. At first the magisters and archons and merchant princes were pleased to welcome the last Targaryens to their homes and tables, but as the years passed and the usurper continued to sit upon the Iron Throne, doors closed and their lives grew meaner. Years passed, they had been forced to sell their last few treasures, and now even the coin they had gotten from Mother's Crown had gone. In the alleys and wine sinks of Pentos, they called her brother the Beggar King. Danny did not want to know what they called her. "We will have it all back some day, sweet sister," he would promise her. Sometimes his hand shook when he talked about it. "The jewels and the silks, Dragonstone and King's Landing, the Iron Throne and the 7 kingdoms, all they have taken from us, we will have it back." Viserys lived for that day. All that Daenerys wanted back was the big house with the red door, the lemon tree outside her window, the childhood she had never known. There came a soft knock on her door. "Come," Danny said, turning away from the window. Illyrio's servants entered, bowed, and set about their business. They were slaves, a gift from the Magister's many Dothraki friends. There was no slavery in the free city of Pentos. Nonetheless, they were slaves. The old woman, small and grey as a mouse, never said a word, but the girl made up for it. She was Illyrio's favourite, a fair-haired, blue-eyed wench of 16 who chattered constantly as she worked. They filled her bath with hot water, brought up from the kitchen, and scented it with fragrant oils. The girl pulled the rough cotton tunic over Danny's head and helped her into the tub. The water was scalding hot, But Daenerys did not flinch or cry out. She liked the heat. It made her feel clean. Besides, her brother had often told her it was never too hot for a Targaryen. "Ours is the House of the Dragon," he would say. "The fire is in our blood." The old woman washed her long, silver-pale hair and gently combed out the snags, all in silence. The girl scrubbed her back and her feet and told her how lucky she was.
"Drogo is so rich that even his slaves wear golden collars. 100,000 men ride in his khalasar, and his palace in Vaes Dothrak hath 200 rooms and doors of solid silver."
There was more like that, so much more. What a handsome man the Carl was, so tall and fierce, fearless in battle, the best rider ever to mount a horse, a demon archer. Daenerys said nothing. She had always assumed that she would wed Viserys when she came of age. For centuries the Targaryens had married brother to sister, since Aegon the Conqueror had taken his sisters to bride. The line must be kept pure, Viserys had told her 1,000 times. Theirs was the king's blood, the golden blood of old Valyria, the blood of the dragon. Dragons did not mate with the beasts of the field, and Targaryens did not mingle their blood with that of lesser men. Yet now Viserys schemed to sell her to a stranger, a barbarian. When she was clean, the slaves helped her from the water and toweled her dry. The girl brushed her hair until it shone like molten silver, while the old woman anointed her with the spice flower perfume of the Dothraki plains, a dab on each wrist, behind her ears, on the tip of her breasts, and one last one, cool on her lips, down there between her legs. They dressed her in the wisps that Magister Illyrio had sent up, and then the gown, a deep plum silk, to bring out the violet in her eyes. The girl slid the gilded sandals onto her feet, while the old woman fixed the tiara in her hair, and slid golden bracelets crusted with amethysts around her wrists. Last of all came the collar, a heavy gold torque emblazoned with ancient Valyrian glyphs.
"Now you look all a princess," the girl said breathlessly when they were done.
Danny glanced at her image in the silvered looking glass that Illyrio had so thoughtfully provided. A princess, she thought. But she remembered what the girl had said, how Khal Drogo was so rich even his slaves wore golden collars. She felt a sudden chill, and goose flesh pimpled her bare arms. Her brother was waiting in the cool of the entry hall, seated on the edge of the pool, his hand trailing in the water. He rose when she appeared and looked her over critically.
"Stand there," he told her. "Turn around. Yes, good. You look..."
"Regal,"
Master Illyrio said, stepping through an archway. He moved with surprising delicacy for such a massive man. Beneath loose garments of flame-coloured silk, rows of fat jiggled as he walked. Gemstones glittered on every finger, and his man had oiled his forked yellow beard until it shone like real gold.
"May the Lord of Light shower you with blessings on this most fortunate day, Princess Daenerys," the Magister said as he took her hand.
He bowed his head, showing a thin glimpse of crooked yellow teeth through the gold of his beard.
"She is a vision, Your Grace, a vision," he told her brother. "Drogo will be enraptured."
"She's too skinny," Viserys said. His hair, the same silver blonde as hers, had been pulled back tightly behind his head and fastened with a dragon bone brooch. It was a severe look that emphasized the hard, gaunt lines of his face. He rested his hand on the hilt of the sword that Illyrio had lent him and said, "Are you sure that Khal Drogo likes his women this young?"
"She has had her blood. She is old enough for the Khal," Illyrio told him, not for the first time. "Look at her, the silver-gold hair, those purple eyes. She is the blood of old Valyria, no doubt, no doubt. And high-born, daughter of the old king, sister to the new, she cannot fail to entrance our Drogo."
When he released her hand, Daenerys found herself trembling. "I suppose," her brother said doubtfully, "the savages have queer tastes, Boys, horses, sheep." "Best not suggest this to Khal Drogo," Illyria said. "Best not suggest this to Khal Drogo," Illyria said. Anger flashed in her brother's lilac eyes. "Do you take me for a fool?" The Magister bowed slightly.
"I take you for a king. Kings lack the caution of common men. My apologies if I have given offence."
He turned away and clapped his hands for his bearers. The streets of Pentos were pitch dark when they set out in Illyrio's elaborately carved palanquin. Two servants went ahead to light their way, carrying ornate oil lanterns with panes of pale blue glass, while a dozen strong men hoisted the poles to their shoulders. It was warm and close inside behind the curtains. Danny could smell the stench of Illyrio's pallid flesh through his heavy perfumes. Her brother, sprawled out on the pillows beside her, never noticed. His mind was away across a narrow sea. "We won't need his whole Kalasar," Viserys said. His fingers toyed with the hilt of his borrowed blade, though Danny knew he had never used a sword in earnest.
10,000, that would be enough. I could sweep the Seven Kingdoms with 10,000 Dothraki screamers. The realm will rise for its rightful king. Tyrell, Redwyn, Dary, Greyjoy, they have no more love for the usurper than I do. The Dornish men burn to avenge Ilya and her children, and the small folk will be with us. They cry out for their king. He looked at Illyrio anxiously.
Well, they do, don't they?
They are your people, and they love you well, Master Illyrio said amiably. In Holdfast across the realm, men lift secret toasts to your health, while women sew dragon banners and hide them against the day of your return from across the water.
He gave a massive shrug.
Or so my agents tell me.
Danny had no agents, no way of knowing what anyone was doing or thinking across the narrow sea, but she mistrusted Illyrio's sweet words, as she mistrusted everything about Illyrio. Her brother was nodding eagerly, however.
I shall kill the usurper myself, he promised, who had never killed anyone, as he killed my brother Rhaegar and Lannister too, the Kingslayer, for what he did to my father.
That would be most fitting, Magister Illyrio said. Danny saw the smallest hint of a smile playing around his full lips, but her brother did not notice. Nodding, he pushed back a curtain and stared off into the night, and Danny knew he was fighting the Battle of the Trident once again. The nine tarred manse of Khal Drogo sat beside the waters of the bay, its high brick walls overgrown with pale ivy. It had been given to the Khal by the Magisters of Pentos, Illyrio told them. The free cities were always generous with the horse lords. It is not that we fear these barbarians, Illyrio would explain with a smile.
The Lord of Light would hold our city walls against 1,000,000 Dothraki, or so the Red Priests promise. Yet why take chances when their friendship comes so cheap?
Their palanquin was stopped at the gate, the curtains pulled roughly back by one of the house guards. He had the copper skin and dark almond eyes of a Dothraki, but his face was hairless, and he wore the spiked bronze cap of the Unsullied. He looked them over coldly. Magister Illyrio growled something to him in the rough Dothraki tongue. The guardsman replied in the same voice and waved them through the gates. Danny noticed that her brother's hand was clenched tightly around the hilt of his borrowed sword. He looked almost as frightened as she felt.
"Insolent eunuch," Viserys muttered, as a palanquin lurched up toward the manse.
Magistro Illyrio's words were honey.
"Many important men will be at the feast tonight. Such men have enemies. The Khal must protect his guests. Yourself chief among them, your grace. No doubt the usurper would pay well for your head."
"Oh, yes," Viserys said darkly. "He has tried, Illyrio, I promise that. His hard knives follow us everywhere. I'm the last dragon, and he will not sleep easy while I live." The palanquin slowed and stopped. The curtains were thrown back, and a slave offered a hand to help Daenerys out. His colour, she noted, was ordinary bronze. Her brother followed, one hand still clenched hard around his sword hilt. It took two strong men to get Magister Illyrio back on his feet. Inside the manse, the air was heavy with the scent of spices, pinch fire and sweet lemon and cinnamon. They were escorted across the entry hall, where a mosaic of coloured glass depicted the doom of Valyria. Oil burned in black iron lanterns all along the walls. Beneath an arch of twining stone leaves, a eunuch sang their coming.
"Viserys of the House Targaryen, the third of his name," he called in a high, sweet voice. "King of the Andals and the Ronar, and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm. His sister Daenerys Stormborn, Princess of Dragonstone. His honourable host, Illyrio Mepatis, Magister of the Free City of Pentos."
They stepped past the eunuch into a pillared courtyard overgrown in pale ivory. Moonlight painted the leaves in shades of bone and silver as the guests drifted among them. Many were Dothraki horse lords, big men with red bronze skin, their drooping mustachios bound in metal rings, their black hair oiled and braided and hung with bells. Yet among them moved bravos and sellswords from Pentos and Myr and Tyrosh. A red priest even fatter than Illyrio, hairy men from the port of Ibon, and lords from the Summer Isles with skins as black as ebony. Daenerys looked at them all in wonder and realized with a sudden start of fear that she was the only woman there. Illyrio whispered to them, "Those three are Drago's blood riders there," he said. "By the pillars Carl Murrow, with his son Rhaegaro. The man with the green beard is brother to the Archon of Tyrosh, and the man behind him is Seer Jorah Mormont." The last name caught Daenerys. "A knight? No less," Illyrio smiled through his beard, "anointed with the seven oils by the High Septon himself." "What is he doing here?" she blurted. "The usurper wanted his head," Illyrio told them. "Some trifling affront. He sold some poachers to a Tyroshi slaver instead of giving them to the Night's Watch. Absurd law. A man should be able to do as he likes with his own chattel." "I shall wish to speak with Seer Jorah before the night is done," her brother said. Dany found herself looking at the knight curiously. He was an older man, past 40 and balding, but still strong and fit. Instead of silks and cottons, he wore wool and leather. His tunic was a dark green, embroidered with the likeness of a black bear standing on two legs. She was still looking at this strange man from the homeland she had never known, when Magister Illyrio placed a moist hand on her bare shoulder. "Over there, sweet princess," he whispered. "There is the Carl himself." Dany wanted to run and hide, but her brother was looking at her, and if she displeased him, she knew she would wake the dragon. Anxiously she turned and looked at the man Viserys hoped would ask to wed her before the night was done. The slave girl had not been far wrong, she thought. Khal Drogo was a head taller than the tallest man in the room, yet somehow light on his feet, as graceful as a panther in Illyrio's menagerie. He was younger than she'd thought, no more than 30. His skin was the colour of polished copper, his thick mustachios bound with gold and bronze rings. "I must go and make my submissions," Magister Illyrio said. "Wait here. I shall bring him to you." Her brother took her by the arm as Illyrio waddled off to the carl, his fingers squeezing so hard that they hurt. "Do you see his braid, sweet sister?" Drogo's braid was black as midnight and heavy with scented oil, hung with tiny bells that rang softly as he moved. It swung well past his belt, even below his buttocks, the end of it brushing against the back of his thighs. "You see how long it is," Viserys said. "When Dothraki are defeated in combat, they cut off their braids in disgrace, so the world will know their shame. Khal Drogo has never lost a fight.
He is Aegon, the Dragon Lord, come again, and you will be his queen.
Danny looked at Khal Drogo. His face was hard and cruel, his eyes as cold and dark as onyx. Her brother hurt her sometimes, when she woke the dragon, but he did not frighten her the way this man frightened her. "I don't want to be his queen," she heard herself say in a small, thin voice. "Please, please, Viserys, I don't want to. I want to go home."
"Home?" He kept his voice low, but she could hear the fury in his tone. "How are we to go home, sweet sister? They took her home from us."
He drew her into the shadows out of sight, his fingers digging into her skin.
"How are we to go home?"
he repeated, meaning King's Landing and Dragonstone and all the realm they had lost. Danny had only meant their rooms and Illyrio's estate. No true home, surely, though all they had, but her brother did not want to hear that. There was no home there for him. Even the big house with the red door had not been home for him. His fingers dug hard into her arm, demanding an answer.
"I don't know," she said at last, her voice breaking, the tears welling in her eyes.
"I do," he said sharply. "We go home with an army, sweet sister, with Khal Drogo's army. That is how we go home. And if you must wed him and bed him for that, you will."
He smiled at her.
"I'll let his whole Khalasar fuck you if need be, sweet sister, all 40,000 men, and their horses too, if that was what it took to get my army. Be grateful is only Drogo. In time, you may even learn to like him. Now dry your eyes, Illyrio is bringing him over, and he will not see you crying."
Danny turned and saw it was true. Master Illyrio, all smiles and bows, was escorting Khal Drogo over to where they stood. She brushed away unfallen tears with the back of her hand.
"Smile," Viserys whispered nervously, his hand falling to the hilt of his sword. "And stand up straight. Let him see that you have breasts. Guards, no, you have little enough as it is."
Daenerys smiled and stood up straight.
John. The white wolf raced to a black wood, beneath a pale cliff as tall as the sky. The moon ran with him, slipping through a tangle of bare branches overhead across the starry sky.
"Snow!"
the moon murmured. The wolf made no answer. Snow crunched beneath his paws. The wind sighed through the trees. Far off he could hear his packmates calling to him, like to like. They were hunting too. A wild rain lashed down upon his black brother as he tore at the flesh of an enormous goat, washing the blood from his side where the goat's long horn had raked him. In another place, his little sister lifted her head to sing to the moon, and 100 small grey cousins broke off their hunt to sing with her. The hills were warmer where they were, and full of food. Many a night his sister's pack gorged on the flesh of sheep and cows and horses, the prey of men, and sometimes even on the flesh of man himself.
"Snow!"
the moon called down again, cackling. The white wolf padded along the man trail beneath the icy cliff. The taste of blood was on his tongue, and his ears rang to the song of the 100 cousins. Once they had been 6, 5 whimpering blind in the snow beside their dead mother, sucking cool milk from her hard dead nipples whilst he crawled off alone. 4 remained, and 1 the white wolf could no longer sense.
"Snow!"
the moon insisted. The white wolf ran from it, racing toward the cave of night where the sun had hidden, his breath frosting in the air. On starless nights, the great cliff was as black as stone, a darkness towering high above the wide world. But when the moon came out, it shimmered pale and icy as a frozen stream. The wolf's pelt was thick and shaggy, but when the wind blew along the ice, no fur could keep the chill out. On the other side, the wind was colder still, the wolf sensed. That was where his brother was,
the grey brother, who smelled of summer.
"Snow!"
An icicle tumbled from a branch. The white wolf turned and bared his teeth.
"Snow!"
His fur rose bristling as the woods dissolved around him.
"Snow! Snow! Snow!"
He heard the beat of wings. Through the gloom, a raven flew. It landed on Jon Snow's chest with a thump and a scrabbling of claws.
"Snow!"
it screamed into his face. "I hear you." The room was dim, his palate hard. Grey light leaked through the shutters, promising another bleak, cold day. "Is this how you woke Mormont? Get your feathers out of my face." Jon wriggled an arm out from under his blankets to shoo the raven off. It was a big bird, old and bold and scruffy, utterly without fear.
"Snow!"
it cried, flapping to his bedpost.
"Snow! Snow!"
Jon filled his fist with a pillow and let fly. But the bird took to the air. The pillow struck the wall and burst, scattering stuffing everywhere, just as Dolorous Ed Tullet poked his head through the door. "Big pardon," he said, ignoring the flurry of feathers. "Shall I fetch me lord some breakfast?"
"Corn!"
cried the raven.
"Corn! Corn!"
"Roast raven," Jon suggested, "and half a pint of ale." Having a steward fetch and serve for him still felt strange. Not long ago, it would have been him fetching breakfast for Lord Commander Mormont. "Three corns and one roast raven," said Dolores Head. "Very good, my lord. Only hubs made boiled eggs, eh? Black sausage and apples stewed with prunes. The apples stewed with prunes are excellent, except for the prunes. I won't eat prunes myself. Well, there was one time when Hub chopped them up with chestnuts and carrots and hid them in a hen. Never trust a cook, my lord. They'll prune you when you least expect it." Later. Breakfast could wait. Stannis could not. "Any trouble from the stockades last night?"
"Not since you put guards on the guards, my lord."
"Good." A thousand wildlings had been penned up beyond the wall, the captives Stannis Baratheon had taken when his knights had smashed Mance Rayder's patchwork host. Many of the prisoners were women, and some of the guards had been sneaking them out to warm their beds. King's men, queen's men, it did not seem to matter. A few black brothers had tried the same thing. Men were men, and these were the only women for a thousand leagues.
"Two more wildlings turn up to surrender," Ed went on. A mother with a girl clinging to her skirts. She had a boy babe, too, all swaddled up in fur. But he was dead."
"Dead,"
said the raven. It was one of the bird's favourite words.
"Dead, dead, dead."
They had free folk drifting in most every night. Starved, half-frozen creatures who had run from the battle beneath the wall, only to crawl back when they realized there was no safe place to run to. "Was the mother question?" Jon asked. Stannis Baratheon had smashed Mance Rayder's host and made the king beyond the wall his captive. But the wildlings were still out there, the Weeper and Tormund Giantsbane and thousands more.
"Oi, my lord," said Ed. "But all she knows is that she ran off during the battle and hid in the woods after. We filled her full of porridge, sent her to the pens, and burnt the babe."
Burning dead children had ceased to trouble Jon Snow. Live ones were another matter. "Two kings to wake the dragon, the father first, then the son, so both die kings." The words had been murmured by one of the queen's men as Maester Aemon had cleaned his wounds. Jon had tried to dismiss them as his fever talking. Aemon had demurred.
"There is power in a king's blood," the old maester had warned, "and better men than Stannis have done worse things than this."
"The king can be harsh and unforgiving, aye, but a babe still on the breast? Only a monster would give a living child to the flames." Jon pissed in darkness, filling his chamber pot as the old bear's raven muttered complaints. The wolf dreams had been growing stronger, and he found himself remembering them even when awake. Ghost knows that Grey Wind is dead. Rob had died at the Twins, betrayed by men he'd believed his friends, and his wolf had perished with him. Bran and Rickon had been murdered too, beheaded at the behest of Theon Greyjoy, who had once been their Lord Father's ward. But if dreams did not lie, their dire wolves had escaped. At Queen's Crown, one had come out of the darkness to save John's life. Summer, it had to be. His fur was grey, and Shaggy Dog is black. He wondered if some part of his dead brothers lived on inside their wolves. He filled his basin from a flagon of water beside his bed, washed his face and hands, donned a clean set of black woolens, laced up a black leather jerkin, and pulled on a pair of well-worn boots. Mormont's raven watched with shrewd black eyes, then fluttered to the window. "Do you take me for your thrall?" When John folded back the window with its thick diamond-shaped panes of yellow glass, the chill of the morning hit him in the face. He took a breath to clear away the cobwebs of the night as the raven flapped away. Ah, that bird is too clever by half. It had been the old bear's companion for years, but that had not stopped it from eating Mormont's face once he died. Outside his bedchamber, a flight of steps descended to a larger room, furnished with a scarred pinewood table and a dozen oak and leather chairs. With Stannis in the King's Tower and the Lord Commander's Tower burnt to a shell, John had established himself in Donal Noy's modest rooms behind the armory. In time, no doubt, he would need larger quarters, but for the moment these would serve, whilst he accustomed himself to command. The grant that the king had presented him for signature was on the table beneath the silver drinking cup that had once been Donal Noy's. The one-armed smith had left few personal effects: the cup, six pennies, and a copper star, a niello brooch with a broken clasp, a musty brocade doublet that bore the stag of Storm's End. His treasures were his tools, and the swords and knives he made. His life was at the forge. John moved the cup aside and read the parchment once again. "If I put my seal to this, I will forever be remembered as the Lord Commander who gave away the wall," he thought. "But if I should refuse..." Stannis Baratheon was proving to be a prickly guest, and a restless one. He had ridden down the King's Road almost as far as Queen's Crown, prowled through the empty hovels of Molestown, inspected the ruined forts at Queen's Gate and Oakenshield. Each night he walked atop the wall with Lady Melisandre, and during the days he visited the stockades, picking captives out for the Red Woman to question. He does not like to be balked. This would not be a pleasant morning, John feared. From the armory came a clatter of shields and swords, as the latest lot of boys and raw recruits armed themselves. He could hear the voice of Iron Emmet telling them to be quick about it. Cutter Pike had not been pleased to lose him, but the young ranger had a gift for training men. He loves to fight, and he'll teach his boys to love it too, or so he hoped. John's cloak hung on a peg by the door, his sword belt on another. He donned them both and made his way to the armory. The rug where Ghost slept was empty, he saw. Two guardsmen stood inside the doors, clad in black cloaks and iron half-helms, spears in their hands. "Will my lord be wanting a tale?" asked Garth. "I think I can find the King's Tower by myself." John hated having guards trailing after him everywhere he went. It made him feel like a mother duck leading a procession of ducklings. Arn Emmett's lads were well at it in the yard, blunted swords slamming into shields and ringing against one another. John stopped to watch a moment as Horse pressed Hop Robin back toward the well. Horse had the makings of a good fighter, he decided. He was strong and getting stronger, and his instincts were sound. Hop Robin was another tale. His club foot was bad enough, but he was afraid of getting hit as well. Perhaps we can make a steward of him. The fight ended abruptly, with Hop Robin on the ground. Well fought, John said to Horse, but you dropped your shield too low when pressing an attack. You will want to correct that, or it is like to get you killed.
Yes, milord. I'll keep it higher next time.
Horse pulled Hop Robin to his feet, and the smaller boy made a clumsy bow. A few of Stannis' knights were sparring on the far side of the yard. King's men in one corner and Queen's men in another, John did not fail to note, but only a few. It's too cold for most of them. As he strode past them, a booming voice called after him, "Boy! You there! Boy!" Boy was not the worst of the things that Jon Snow had been called since being chosen Lord Commander. He ignored it.
"Snow!" the voice insisted. "Lord Commander!"
This time he stopped. "Sir?" The knight overtopped him by 6 inches.
"A man who bears Valyrian steel should use it for more than scratching his arse."
John had seen this one about the castle, a knight of great renown, to hear him tell it. During the battle beneath the wall, Sir Godfrey Faring had slain a fleeing giant, pounding after him on horseback and driving a lance through his back, then dismounting to hack off the creature's pitiful small head. The Queen's men had taken to calling him Godfrey the Giant Slayer. John remembered Ygritte crying, "I am the last of the giants. I use Longclaw when I must, sir." How well, though, Sir Godfrey drew his own blade. "Show us. I promise not to hurt you, lad." "How kind of you. Some other time, sir. I fear I have other duties just now."
"Oh, you fear? I see that." Sir Godfrey grinned at his friends. "He fears," he repeated, for the slow ones.
"You will excuse me." John showed them his back. Castle Black seemed a bleak and forlorn place in the pale dawn light. "My command," John Snow reflected ruefully, "as much a ruin as it is a stronghold. The Lord Commander's tower was a shell, the common hall a pile of blackened timbers, and Harden's tower looked as if the next gust of wind would knock it over, though it had looked that way for years. Behind them rose the wall, immense, forbidding, frigid, a crawl with builders pushing up a new switchback stair to join the remnants of the old. They worked from dawn to dusk. Without the stair, there was no way to reach the top of the wall, save by winch. That would not serve if the wildlings should attack again. Above the King's Tower, the great golden battle standard of House Baratheon cracked like a whip from the roof where Jon Snow had prowled with bow in hand not long ago, slaying thens and free folk beside Satin and Deaf Dick Follard. Two Queen's men stood shivering on the steps, their hands tucked up into their armpits and their spears leaning against the door. "Those cloth gloves will never serve," John told them. "See Burn Marsh on the morrow, and he'll give you each a pair of leather gloves lined with fur."
"We will, my lord, and thank you," said the older guard.
"That's if our bloody hands aren't froze off," the younger added, his breath of pale mist. "I used to think that it got cold up in the Dornish marshes. Oh, what did I know?"
"Nothing," thought Jon Snow. "The same as me." Halfway up the winding steps, he came upon Samwell Tarly, headed down. "Are you coming from the king?" Jon asked him.
"Master Aemon sent me with a letter."
"I see. Some lords trusted their maesters to read their letters and convey the contents, but Stannis insisted on breaking the seals himself. How did Stannis take it?"
"Not happily, by his face." Sam dropped his voice to a whisper.
I am not supposed to speak of it.
Then don't. John wondered which of his father's bannermen had refused King Stannis homage this time. He was quick enough to spread the word when Carhold declared for him. How are you and your longbow getting on?
I found a good book about archery.
Sam frowned.
Doing it is harder than reading about it, though. I get blisters.
Keep at it. We may need your bow on the wall if the others turn up some dark night.
Oh, I hope not.
More guards stood outside the king's solar.
No arms are allowed in his gracious presence, my lord,
their sergeant said.
I'll need that sword, your knives as well.
It would be no good to protest, John knew. He handed them his weaponry. Within the solar, the air was warm. Lady Melisandre was seated near the fire, her ruby glimmering against the pale skin of her throat. Ygritte had been kissed by fire. The Red Priestess was fire, and her hair was blood and flame. Stannis stood beside the rough-hewn table, where the old bear had once been wont to sit and take his meals. Covering the table was a large map of the north, painted on a ragged piece of hide. A tallow candle weighed down one end of it, a steel gauntlet the other. The king wore lamb's wool breeches and a quilted doublet, yet somehow he looked as stiff and uncomfortable as if he had been clad in plate and mail. His skin was pale leather, his beard cropped so short that it might have been painted on. A fringe about his temples was all that remained of his black hair. In his hand was a parchment with a broken seal of dark green wax. John took a knee. The king frowned at him and rattled the parchment angrily.
"Rise. Tell me, who is Lyanna Mormont?"
"One of Lady Major's daughters, sire, the youngest. She was named for my lord father's sister." "To curry your lord father's favour, I don't doubt. I know how that game is played. How old is this wretched girl child?" John had to think a moment. 10, or near enough to make no matter. "Might I know how she has offended your grace?" Stannis read from the letter. "Bear Island knows no king but the king in the north, whose name is Stark. A girl of 10, you say, and she presumes to scold her lawful king." His close-cropped beard lay like a shadow over his hollow cheeks. "See that you keep these tidings to yourself, Lord Snow. Carhold is with me. That's all the men need to know. I will not have your brothers trading tales of how this child spat on me."
"As you command, sire."
Mage Mormont had ridden south with Rob, John knew. Her eldest daughter had joined the young wolf's host as well. Even if both of them had died, however, Lady Mage had other daughters, some with children of their own. Had they gone with Rob as well? Surely Lady Mage would have left at least one of the older girls behind as Castellan. He did not understand why Lyanna should be writing Stannis, and could not help but wonder if the girl's answer might have been different, if the letter had been sealed with a direwolf instead of a crowned stag, and signed by John Stark, Lord of Winterfell. It's too late for such misgivings. You made your choice.
20 ravens were sent out, the king complained, yet we get no response but silence and defiance. Homage is the duty every leal subject owes his king.
Yet your father's bannermen all turn their backs on me, save the Karstarks. Is Arnulf Karstark the only man of honour in the north? Arnulf Karstark was the late Lord Rickard's uncle. He had been made the castellan of Carhold when his nephew and his sons went south with Rob, and he had been the first to respond to King Stannis' call for homage, with a raven declaring his allegiance. "The Karstarks have no other choice," John might have said. Rickard Karstark had betrayed the direwolf and spilled the blood of lions. The stag was Carhold's only hope. In times as confused as these, even men of honour must wonder where their duty lies.
Your Grace is not the only king in the realm demanding homage." Lady Melisandre stirred.
"Tell me, Lord Snow, where were these other kings when the wild people stormed your wall?"
1,000 leagues away, and deaf to our need," John replied. "I have not forgotten that, my lady, nor will I. But my father's bannermen have wives and children to protect, and small folk who will die should they choose wrongly. His Grace asked much of them. Give them time, and you will have your answers."
"Answers such as this?"
Stannis crushed Lyanna's letter in his fist. "Even in the north, men fear the wrath of Tywin Lannister. Boltons make bad enemies as well. It is not happenstance that put a flayed man on their banners. The north rode with Robb, bled with him, died for him. They have supped on grief and death, and now you come to offer them another serving? Do you blame them if they hang back? Forgive me, Your Grace, but some will look at you and see only another doomed pretender."
"If His Grace is doomed, your realm is doomed as well," said Lady Melisandre. "Remember that, Lord Snow. It is the one true king of Westeros who stands before you."
John kept his face a mask. "As you say, my lady." Stannis snorted. "You spend your words as if everyone were a golden dragon. I wonder how much gold do you have laid by?" "Gold? Are those the dragons the Red Woman means to wake? Dragons made of gold?" "Such taxes as we collect are paid in kind, Your Grace. The watch is rich in turnips, but poor in coin." "Turnips are not like to appease Salador San. I require gold or silver." "For that you need White Harbor. The city cannot compare to Old Town or King's Landing, but it is still a thriving port. Lord Manderley is the richest of my lord father's bannermen."
"Lord too fat to sit a horse."
The letter that Lord Wyman Manderley had sent back from White Harbor had spoken of his age and infirmity and little more. Stannis had commanded John not to speak of that one either.
"Perhaps his lordship would fancy a wilding wife," said Lady Melisandre. "Is this fat man married, Lord Snow?"
"His lady wife is long dead. Lord Wyman has 2 grown sons and grandchildren by the elder, and he is too fat to sit a horse. 30 stone at least. Val would never have him."
"Just once, you might try to give me an answer that would please me, Lord Snow," the king grumbled.
"I would hope the truth would please you, sire. Your men call Val a princess, but to the free folk she is only the sister of their king's dead wife. If you force her to marry a man she does not want, she is like to slit his throat on their wedding night. Even if she accepts her husband, that does not mean the wildlings will follow him or you. The only man who can bind them to your cause is Mance Rayder." "I know that," Stannis said, unhappily. "I have spent hours speaking with a man. He knows much and more of our true enemy, and there is cunning in him, I'll grant you. Even if he were to renounce his kingship, though, the man remains an oath-breaker. Suffer one deserter to live, and ye encourage others to desert. No, laws should be made of iron, not of pudding. Mance Rayder's life is forfeit by every law of the 7 kingdoms."
"The law ends at the wall, Your Grace. You can make good use of Mance."
"I mean to. I'll burn him, and the North will see how I deal with turncloaks and traitors. I have other men to lead the wildlings, and I have Rayder's son, do not forget. Once a father dies, his whelp will be the king beyond the wall."
"Your Grace is mistaken."
"You know nothing, Jon Snow,"
Ygritte used to say. But he had learned. "The babe is no more a prince than Val is a princess. You do not become king beyond the wall because your father was."
"Good," said Stannis, "for I will suffer no other kings in Westeros. Have you signed the grant?"
"No, Your Grace." And now it comes. John closed his burned fingers and opened them again. You ask too much.
Ask? I asked you.